books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and on our first show of 2025, we have a look back at 2024. This is our recap, part two. Coming up in today's show, we'll have Booker winner Samantha Harvey. Momfluencers clash in Jesse Satanto's book, You Will Never Be Me. There's a climate crisis in Greg Mossey's book, The Coming Storm. Author of the Glasgow Kiss trilogy, Sophie Gravia, has a hot girl summer. Kirsten Miller takes us to Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books. And up now, Joe Piazza takes us to an Italian island in the Sicilian Inheritance. A century-old unsolved murder. A disputed inheritance. A family secret that some will kill to protect. When Sarah Marsala's beloved great-aunt Rosie passes away, she leaves Sarah a valuable piece of land in Sicily. But there is a catch. The locals refuse to acknowledge the rightful owner of the deed. And if Sarah wants the land, she must first uncover the truth about what happened to her great-great-grandmother, Serafina Marsala. Because Rosie didn't think Serafina died of illness, as family lore states, Rosie believes Serafina was murdered, and she wants Sarah to prove it. The Sicilian Inheritance by Joe Piazza is read by Rachel Hurst and Carlotta Brenton.
I often tried to pinpoint the exact moment when the life I'd worked so hard for began to fall apart. Because there's always a beginning. A place where you've screwed up so badly there's no putting it back together. It's what happens when you slice through the wrong tendon in a flank of meat. I ran a restaurant for years, but I started as a butcher, so I still think in terms of joints and muscles, the connective tissue of life. Cut the right one, and you end up with a perfect steak. Cut the wrong one, and the whole system breaks down. The meat falls apart in the places where you want it to stay close to the bone. Once you make that single wrong cut, it's nearly impossible to keep everything else intact. When did I make the wrong cut? I thought about it, obsessed over it, really, as I closed up my restaurant, probably for the very last time. I was so deep inside my memories that I didn't hear the knock on the door. The sound didn't register until it became an unrelenting pounding. Mommy, let me in! I need to come in there right now! Few things are more persistent than a four-year-old faced with a physical obstacle. Sophie's dad brought her over early. Jack was always early these days, probably because he was trying to catch me doing something he disapproved of. My body lurched toward my little girl's voice. I flung open the door, and the two of us hurled ourselves at one another with a feverish intensity, colliding in a smush of skin and lips and complete and total adoration. I never realized how much I would miss this little creature until I could no longer see her whenever I wanted, until my custody of her hung in the balance.
For me, The Sicilian Inheritance is the most personal novel that I've ever written. It's an adventure, it's a murder mystery, it's a love letter to Sicily, and the highest praise that I've been getting from both readers and listeners is that they stop halfway through the book to look up how much tickets are to go to Sicily, which I love so much. The novel is loosely based on the real-life murder of my great-great-grandmother, Lorenza Marsala, in Sicily about 100 years ago. And my family's been passing this story down for generations, but just tiny nuggets of it. There's two theories. One, that she was possibly killed by the mafia because she crossed the wrong person. That's the story that the men in my family tend to like. And another one, that she was killed for being a witch or a healer, which is the story that the women in my family often tell. And I just wanted to take this little nugget of our family history and turn it into a novel, turn it into a very escapist novel. It takes place on two timelines, a present day woman who returns to Sicily to claim a family inheritance, and then a woman in the past who is left in Sicily alone when her husband goes to the States to, try to make a living for himself and his family. And she kind of gets power for the first time. She becomes a healer and a doctor. And when women get power, it's often dangerous for them. And so there are nefarious forces that are against her. And the woman in the modern day is trying to solve her own ancestors' murder mystery as well. So, I mean, it's a delicious beach read. We're so excited for people to have The Sicilian Inheritance this summer to both listen to and read. Our audiobook narrators are incredible. I auditioned so many people for the two roles of Sarah and Serafina, and I've already listened to our audiobook twice. I've also created a companion podcast because I'm a podcaster where I try to solve the real life murder of my great great grandmother by going back to Sicily with my three children under the age of six. So it's kind of like White Lotus meets Only Murders in the Building, but that's also called The Sicilian Inheritance. And it's a fun listen if you end up loving the book and just want a little bit more of this world.
Serafina, 1908. The girl is cursed. My mother whispered this to my father late at night, even though she knew I could hear her through the wall. Mama sensed I'd been wicked, that I'd brought shame on our family. But all she muttered was, "The girl is cursed," like what was happening to me was all the result of the devil's magic. Before the sun rose the next morning, Cettina and I visited La Strega, the witch, to try to undo the terrible thing I had done. The old woman lived beyond the end of the road. As we walked higher and higher around the steep curve of the hillside, the stone path turned to gravel and then to dirt. My skin tingled with the uncomfortable feeling I'd been tricked, like maybe Leoni and Gio would jump out from behind a tree and laugh at us for believing in fairy tales. Sheep bells chimed in the distance, calling us back home. Cettina, my oldest friend, the closest thing I had to a sister, led the way, gripping my hand so hard my bones ached.
Now, when you're writing a book like this that's in a dual timeline, do you alternate between the two timelines, or do you do one first and then do the other one?
I alternate. I do. And, I'm not a plotter. I'm not an outliner. So I have an idea for a book, and then I sit down and I write between 2,000 and 2,500 words a day. And so with this one, I did write straight through. But then what I did was I took apart the two timelines and I read each of them on their own to make sure that they could stand alone as individual books if they had to, and then did a lot of edits and then read them through together to make sure they were lining up in terms of plot points and narrative and like just little Easter eggs along the way.
Now, I hate putting things in boxes, but would you describe it as a thriller or a mystery or a romance, or would you say it's all of the above?
I'm going to say it's all of the above. And that's what a lot of people have said in the reviews, that, this book does have something for readers who enjoy all of those genres. It's definitely thriller, it's definitely mystery, but there is some romance. And it's also historical fiction, but not very heavy-handed historical fiction. I think both timelines are fun. And the book, I mean, even though it's a murder mystery, it is very joyful. And readers are telling me that they devoured it in one or two nights, which is just the highest praise that you can get as an author.
Joe Piazza's whole interview can be found in episode 382. Now, from an Italian island to a little library, Kirsten Miller takes us to Lula Dean's little library of banned books. Beverly Underwood and her arch enemy, Lula Dean, live in the tiny town of Troy, Georgia, where they were born and raised. Now, Beverly is on the school board, and Lula has become a local celebrity by embarking on a mission to rid the public libraries of all inappropriate books, none of which she has actually read. to replace the pornographic books she's challenged at the local public library, Lola starts her own library in front of her house. A cute wooden hutch with glass doors and neat rows of worthy literature. But what she doesn't know is that a local troublemaker has stolen her wholesome books, removed their dust jackets, and restocked Lola's library with banned books, literary classics, gay romances, black history, witchy spell books, Judy Blume novels, and more. The audio version of Lola Dean's little library of banned books is read by January Lavoie.
Beverly Underwood just wanted life to go back to normal. You wouldn't think that would be such a controversial position, but you couldn't predict how people were going to react these days. Seemed like everyone was always itching to fight. I'm touched that you came down from college, sweetheart, but I can handle this. I really don't think it's worth you missing any more school. Beverly didn't like to see her daughter scowling. Beauty like Lindsay's was a gift from God, and it felt like a sin to hide it. Is it true you don't need any help? Lindsay shot back. Or are you worried your gay kid will get in the way? Beverly slid forward on the couch cushion and grasped Lindsay's hand. Oh, good gracious, no. How could you say such a thing? Her daughter may have been 21 years old, but she was still Mama's baby, and Beverly couldn't have been any prouder. Your father and I have given you our full support since that Barbie incident back in first grade. You being gay has never made one bit of difference to us. Then why are you telling me to get lost? Beverly gasped. You think that's what we're saying? She turned to her husband for support. Trip, did you hear that?
I'm sorry.
Trip Underwood looked up from his crossword puzzle.
What did you say?
Beverly fixed her frown before she turned back to her daughter.
Lindsay, that is not what we're saying. You will always be welcome in this house. All I'm asking now is that you finish out your semester while I try to put all this unpleasantness behind us.
Lindsay studied her mother and shook her head.
I can't believe it,
she finally announced.
You're terrified of Lola Dean.
Once upon a time, Beverly would have laughed at the suggestion. Now she knew better. Truth was, Lola Dean was scary as hell.
Lola Dean's Little Library of Banned Books, very long title. It's set in a small southern town, which is very much like the one where I grew up in rural North Carolina. And it's about the town busybody whose name is Lola Dean. She's one of those people who has always felt like she's never gotten quite enough attention. And one day she's in the library and she happens to find a book of dirty cakes that a teenager has slipped into the library shelves as a joke. And she sees that book as her ticket to fame, if not fortune. And she uses it to start a committee that's dedicated to removing all of the what she calls pornography and communist propaganda from the town's libraries. To prove to everyone that she doesn't actually hate books, she sets up her own little library in her front yard. I don't know if that's a thing in Britain, but here in the States, a lot of people set up these little tiny libraries in their front yards. It's a really sweet thing. So she sets up one of those in her front yard, and she fills it only with the most wholesome books. So 101 Cakes to Bake for Your Family, or The Southern Belle's Guide to Etiquette. And what she doesn't realize is that her arch enemy, lifelong arch enemy's daughter, has come in, and she's taken out all of the wholesome books and switched their covers with books that Lola has banned.
Lord only knows what damage these books have done to the youth of this town. While we weren't paying attention, we may have lost an entire generation. And who's been taking our children? Hold tight, and I'll show you. It's not like he's been hiding. He's been sitting right here on our library shelves.
Lola left the mic, marched over to the nearest box, and plucked a book off the top of the pile. The red, black, and yellow cover showed a terrified boy, his body licked by flames.
Recognize this? Lola called out. Y'all know who the Lord of the Flies is, don't you? You think it's a coincidence this book's named after the devil? He's been right here in Troy, and he's opened the door to a whole slew of demons. Anarchists and pedophiles and socialized health care. He's the reason your children complain about going to church. He's why your doors have to be locked when you leave the house. Without the Lord of the Flies, kids wouldn't be getting kidnapped or groomed or given double mastectomies.
Lula paused to catch her breath, and Beverly saw a flash of uncertainty. For a moment, even Lula seemed to wonder if she'd gone too far. Beverly glanced over her shoulder at the audience. The faces she saw all appeared fearful, but it was impossible to know what exactly had scared them.
So one by one, the townsfolk of this little town called Troy, Georgia, they come by, they pick a book, and they get a banned book that ends up changing their life in an unexpected and often pretty profound way. So it's funny, but it's also very, very serious because I think as everyone knows, we're having quite a problem with book banning here in the United States. It's not our only problem, unfortunately. But yes, it's quite timely.
That's what I was going to say. It is very relevant because, well, you mention in the book about real books that have been banned in places like Florida and Georgia. What sort of books are on that banned list?
Well, you know, it's funny because this is the people who are banning them, they talk about protecting the children, right? So they come into the libraries and they really do the whole sort of pornography and communist propaganda thing. Those are words that they actually use. But what's funny is they don't actually ever go to the romance section. A lot of dirty books in the romance section. They don't take out the romance books. They don't take out the horror books. They don't take out, you know, all of the things that you think might actually scare a kid. They know what they're removing more often than not. Our books are on Black history. There are several books about the Holocaust that the book banners love to pull. They like anything with a gay or LGBTQ protagonist. Those often get pulled. So it's not the books that you would think. You know, I mean, as somebody who read the Amityville Horror when they were 7 years old, I could see somebody making a case for 7-year-olds not reading, you know, the Amityville Horror. But those aren't the books that they're taking away. They're taking away books about history that they don't like.
Kirsten Miller's whole interview can be found in episode 383.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
We're having our second recap of 2024 here on Read On. And now, author of the Glasgow Kiss trilogy, Sophie Gravia, has a hot girl summer. Sophie Gravia's new book, Hot Girl Summer, is out now. Sophie was a nurse, still is in fact, who started writing as a distraction from the ongoing pandemic in 2020. First with her blog, Sex in the Glasgow City, then with her debut novel, A Glasgow Kiss, which, as we'll find out later on, was a literal overnight sensation. Hot Girl Summer, as I said, is out now and it's her fourth book. But let's start at the beginning. A Glasgow Kiss, as with all of Sophie's books, is narrated by Kira Lucchese.
Name, Zara Smith. Age, 29. Location, Glasgow. Interested in, males. Zodiac sign, Leo. Biography. My name is Zara. I've been single for around 5 years now. My hobbies include hill walking, good food, and lots of cocktail drinking. No kids, own house, living life to the fullest. I'm looking for someone to share similar interests with and finally settle down. God, that was difficult. Cringeworthy and incredibly dishonest of me. I never anticipated online dating at this age. I always envisioned myself married in my 20s and to at least be thinking about having kids now. I didn't even contemplate that finding a guy to commit to me would be an issue.
Kira Lucchese reading from A Glasgow Kiss by Sophie Gravia. And let me say, it wasn't easy to find a broadcastable clip of that or any of Sophie's books, so please bear that in mind. This interview is safe for work, but the books certainly aren't. I started by asking Sophie what got her into writing.
It basically all started because I had actually watched this Tony Robbins documentary on Netflix with my friend. So obviously I'm a nurse and I'd done nursing full time, but as you can imagine, it doesn't pay the bills very well at all. I'm also a single mum. I was watching this documentary. It was like The Secret on Netflix. It was all like about light bulb moments, what to do to change your life. I knew something in my life had to change. Although I love nursing, it just wasn't paying the bills. And I thought, surely there's more to life than this sort of 9-to-5 job that was absolutely hammering me. So I watched this documentary one night with my friend, just having a girls' night, and it was all about light bulb moments, like I said. And at the end of the documentary, I randomly says to my friend, you know, I think I've just had one of those light bulb moments. Now, she's the sort of friend that would be like, she would back you up in any situation. She's like, oh, 100%, what is it? I said, I think I want to write something. And she's like, yeah, you should. Bear in mind, I didn't have a background in writing at all. And she was like, what do you want to write? And I was just like, oh, I'm not sure. Maybe a children's book? Like, I wasn't too sure at all. But I just had that feeling there when I was watching that. It was so random. So a few days later, obviously, the idea dropped away from your head and I forgot all about it until probably about 6 months later. I had recently discovered Tinder and I just joined Tinder and I went on this date that was particularly bad. It was horrendous. It was an eventful date, that's all I'm saying. But the next day I was actually going on holiday to Ibiza for a hen do. So I had came in that morning and jumped basically straight on the plane. And we were sitting around the pool later on that afternoon. And I says to the girls I was in the hen do with, you know, this the weirdest thing ever happened to me last night. And I was still like processing it. And they said, why, what happened? And I started to tell them all about this date. And the girls were absolutely killing themselves laughing. And one of them says to me, you know, you should blog this. And as soon as she said that, I thought back to the Tony Robbins light bulb moment probably 6 months earlier. And I thought, that's so strange that she said that. So when I went back from my holiday, I created Sex in the Glasgow City blog and I basically wrote my first blog totally anonymously. No one knew I was doing it. And straight away, it was starting to get thousands and thousands of hits. So that's basically where it all started.
And the actual book itself, that was written during COVID?
Yeah, I'd basically written a few blogs and then COVID happened. So we were stuck in lockdown. Obviously, I'm in the hospital, so it's horrendous at this particular time. It was right at the start, and you couldn't see any of your family, couldn't do anything. My kids were doing 12-hour shifts in a hub as well that the hospital had put on for like healthcare workers. So they were very much involved in it, and we went to this wellness meeting that the staff had to go to like every so often, particularly after a bad day. And in this wellness meeting, we had to go around the room and say one thing that we were doing for ourselves during COVID to basically escape it. And all these doctors and things were part of the wellness meeting, and they were all saying, you know, started learning these new languages. And, you know, as it was approaching me, I'm thinking, oh my God, think something. And then it came to me and they were like, what are you doing? And I was like, nothing. They were like, you must be doing something. I was like, I'm watching Netflix. I'm literally doing nothing. So I was totally shamed at that meeting. And then I thought, I went home that night and I thought, you know, you really enjoyed doing the blogs. Why not make it into a book? Like, you're never going to have this time again to do something like that. So I started writing A Glasgow Kiss, just basically for myself, thinking that my friends would maybe want to read it, or the people that had read the blogs would maybe read it. But I had no idea what it was going to turn into at the time, which in a way was quite nice to write about, because there was no pressure, no outside pressure from anyone.
Now, nearing the end of my 20s, reality is set in and panic has begun. Yes, I'm very much single, with no one to text or sext. I spent 10 agonising years of my life completely infatuated with a Glasgow Ned who would use me occasionally for weekend hookups. Well, until he met a younger, prettier model and married her instead. Of course, by the time I finally realised just how pathetic I was being and felt ready to move on, I was completely past the hot stage of my life, and any confidence I had in regards to speaking to another man was gone. My sell-by date is approaching a lot quicker than anticipated, and the fear of being left on the shelf, having missed out on casual dating with the skinniest days of my life a distant memory, has officially become my reality.
And it's sort of a dream how it got published. You self-published it.
Yep.
And it became an overnight success.
Yeah, so I basically self-published. I watched a YouTube video on how to self-publish on Amazon, like KDP. I told my Facebook friends, which at the time wasn't a lot, it was maybe like 300 people, guys, I've written this book and blah, blah, blah. And then I had that total, I think it's a total West of Scotland thing where you think, who the hell do I think I am? This is embarrassing. Like, why have I written a book? So I had the absolute fear. I turned my phone off. And then the next day, when I turned my phone on, it had just blew up overnight. So people had actually went on, read the book, and were sharing it, and they'd read it in one sitting, and then posting about it, and just constant. And when I had went on to the Amazon charts, it was number one in the UK, and it was trending through the charts. So it was literally overnight that it all happened.
Sophie's full interview can be found in episode 387. But next, there's a climate crisis in Greg Mossey's book, The Coming Storm. Greg Moss is described as a writer and encourager of writers. He's currently the founder and leader of the Criterion New Writing Script Development Programme at the Criterion Theatre in London. Since 2015, he has written and produced 25 plays and musicals. But when, during lockdown, it became legal to go to the theatre, he started writing books, both cosy crime novels with the Maisie Cooper mysteries, and climate fiction, or cli-fi books, such as The Coming Darkness and the brand new The Coming Storm. In fact, we spoke on the day The Coming Storm came out. Both the climate fiction books are narrated by Gareth Armstrong, so let's start with book one, The Coming Darkness. Paris, 2037. Alexander Lamarck of the French External Security Service is hunting for eco-terrorists. Experience has taught him there is no one he can trust, not his secretive lover, Mariam, not even his old mentor, Professor Fayard, the man at the centre of the web. He's ready to give up, but he can't. He could be the world's only hope of preventing the coming darkness.
It began very early one Sunday, a hot summer night in 2037, a little before 1 o'clock. Marseille was under curfew, a brownout only a few minutes away. Inside Bunker Martha, the dark shift were on duty. Alexandre Lamarck, a tall man with dark hair and kind eyes, carried a descendant of the Heckler & Koch 45 caliber pistol he'd been issued on his first day of training 12 years before, plus a sonic immobiliser retrieved from the armoury at the local gendarmerie earlier that day. Guaranteed non-lethal, the quartermaster told him, if that's what you're looking for. He stood in deep shadow in an alleyway about 50 meters from the rear of a converted U-boat base, a vast structure still known by its World War II codename. Today it was an international data center, housing a vast array of servers, computers, switches, and routers. The sky was almost clear, the moon and stars visible beyond the wisps of high cirrus clouds. Between Alex and Bunker Martha, a 2-meter fence surrounded a pumping station. Back in the early 2000s, a pragmatic computer engineer whose grandfather had worked the mines above Marseille invented the idea of channeling groundwater from drainage tunnels in the hills, absorbing the waste heat, and then releasing it out into the blue waters of the Mediterranean. An excellent plan, thought Alex, but also an obvious weakness. Somewhere a siren sounded, abrupt but distant. Seconds later, the planned brownout killed the street lamps and plunged the docks, the pleasure port, and the entire industrial zone into darkness. Seconds later, Alex felt the backup generators rumble into life through the soles of his shoes.
Gareth Armstrong reading from The Coming Darkness. And it turns out that it wasn't what Greg Moss intended to write.
I was in Dubai at a literary festival in February 2020 with one of my dearest colleagues in publishing, Luigi Bonomi, who's a wonderful agent, who said to me, Greg, I think I said to you before, you ought to write a cozy crime novel because I think you'd be good at that. And of course I thought, well, if an agent is saying that, I must do it. However, within 4 weeks, we were locked down. And I was sat in the corner of my study thinking, actually these circumstances, these are much more dramatic. And I began with this moment from the middle of The Coming Darkness, which of course you know is set in 2037, when everything that today we're worried about has become more urgent, needing to be addressed much more quickly and perhaps much more dramatically. And what that meant was that I started writing in the middle of the novel, which is something that authors sometimes do. You know, they find some big drama in the middle, and then we have to write up to that drama to find it again. So The Coming Darkness in my study started with the discovery of an unexplained body in a miserable house in a northern suburb of Paris, which set my hero, Alex Lamarck, on the trail of the person whose catastrophic plot he has to try and prevent.
He stayed relaxed, scanning the terrain, the car park with spreading lime trees, the security perimeter, and beyond that the maritime repair yard with its 4-story boat garage. Nothing out of place. He heard the distinctive churring trill of a male nightjar marking its territory, followed by the faint percussive sound of its wing clapping. It was perched atop one of the heavy gateposts near the locked entrance to the pumping station. Suddenly, the bird shot up into the air and flapped away, disturbed by a sound. Alex swept his gaze methodically between the lime trees, looking for what might have disturbed it. There it was, a mid-sized, light-coloured vehicle, 2 dark figures clambering out of the boot, stretching stiffened limbs. Then, whispering, 2 voices, taking care but not enough care, trusting in the curfew and the emptiness of the night. Alex knew who they were. International students from Marseille University, charity placements supposed to foster understanding between peoples. Amaury Barra, the colleague who'd given him the tip-off about the planned attack, had said the suspects were little more than children, that they were almost certainly being manipulated.
And The Coming Storm follows on from The Coming Darkness, but now Alex is... well, he's famous.
Do you know what? I think that is a really interesting question, isn't it? If you're a spy, what do you do if you're recognised everywhere you go as the man who saved the world? I recently did an excellent event with Jack Jewers and Ava Glass, both of whom have also recently published a couple of really brilliant contrasting spy novels, one of them set in the present day in London and the other one in Samuel Pepys's Secret Diary, a historical spy novel. And we were discussing this fact that visibility, recognizability are the last thing that as a spy you want. And so what my hero has to do is he has to change his appearance, but he also has to attack the problem of the continuing conspiracy that he must fight in a different way. And of course, there's relatively little I can tell you about that, because in a thriller, everything from chapter one, well, it's a spoiler.
Yeah, no spoilers here.
Good.
But the coming darkness and the coming storm, they are... We've had books that have mentioned COVID now, but these are, I think, some of the first true pandemic novels.
In the sense that in a world with hypermobility, it's much easier, isn't it, for germs to travel. If we think back to the 15th century and the we can identify, or rather historians, not me, but historians can identify how the bubonic plague came to England at that time. They can almost map its progression as it marched relatively slowly from the Far East to the Near East through Europe. And of course, that's no longer the case. Nothing's going to move slowly. Everything in our world, in our modern world, our hyperactive, hypermobile world, is going to move really quickly. It was a strange coincidence that back at the beginning of 2020, even before I started writing The Coming Darkness, the first in the trilogy, our son, that's Felix Moss, was in Switzerland, and he was playing Marius in Cameron Mackintosh's production of Les Misérables on tour in Europe. And there was one evening, out of about 40 people in the company, that half of them were off. And it was a mysterious, get this, a mysterious flu-like illness. And nobody knew where it was from. And of course, on reflection, it was because that Swiss city was one of the destinations for Chinese holidaymakers coming to Europe in order to go swimming. And therefore, the virus that we didn't know what virus it was already circulating. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it? How all of these things that we experience, they become a part of our imaginary world, and we integrate them in different ways. And to come back to your original question, what I'm saying in The Coming Darkness and The Coming Storm is that in 2037, the fear, or if you like, the management of hypermobile, easily communicated viruses has become second nature.
Greg's whole interview can be found in Read On number 372.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The first talking books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and you know, if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Continuing our recap of 2024 on Read On, and now momfluencers clash in Jesse Satanzo's book, You Will Never Be Me. After the incredible success of Vera Wong's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers and the Dial A for Auntie series, Jesse Satanzo is back with a gripping revenge thriller about toxic friendship and the dark side of social media. When cracks start forming in an influencer's curated life, she finds out that jealousy is just as viral as a video. You Will Never Be Me is out now, and it's been described as Gone Girl if Amy Dunn was a momfluencer. And it will make you question how much you share online. I'll talk to Jessie in a moment about this and some of her other books, but for now, the audio version of You Will Never Be Me is read by Eunice Wong and Risa May.
Meredith. I'm stalking my best friend. There's no use denying it. When I first started, I told myself we were so in sync that we were like the same person torn into two halves, and those two halves were linked by an invisible thread that was always pulling us back to each other, so of course we'd constantly be running into each other. Simpatico. That's what we always used to say. Simpatico. Followed by a wink, content and smug. Because out of almost 8 billion humans in the world, the two of us somehow managed to find our soulmates in each other. And what is that if not pure and beautiful magic? And anyway, it's not really stalking, not like the kind you see in the movies with the stalker prowling in all black. Contrary to popular belief, black is not for everyone. It certainly does my skin tone no favors. A chloroform-soaked rag in one hand and zip ties in the other. I'm not trying to kidnap Bestie. It's more like stalking light. I just want to know how she's doing. I need to see if our earth-shattering fight mauled her the way it did me. That's reasonable. And I sure as hell won't find out anything through her social media accounts, which are all glossed over with giddily jubilant content. No, if I want to see signs of the wreckage underneath, I need to see her in person, catch a glimpse of the tightness around the right corner of her mouth, or the way she licks her lips like a lizard does, a rapid twitch that does nothing to moisten them. And that's why I'm sitting in a car around the corner from the twins' school, waiting for her car to appear out of the drop-off line. Damn it, I know it sounds bad. I'm literally parked outside of her kid's school. But this has nothing to do with her girls, even though I miss Noemi and Alea so much, and I'm sure they must miss Aunt Mare, and Luca misses little Sabine. Don't you, Luca? I coo, glancing back at my 8-month-old son. You miss baby Sabine, don't you, sweetie?
You Will Never Be Me is about two momfluencers. That's mom influencers for those who are lucky enough to have not been exposed to that term. They used to be best friends, but one of them surpassed the other, which led to a falling out. Then this kind of like turned into a really toxic friendship, you know, with social media thrown into the mix and results in a murder.
Aspen. It is not yet 9 in the morning, and I've almost snapped at Alea 3 separate times. The first was when I was trying to get a photo of the beautiful stack of sourdough pancakes to post to my stories, and she stabbed her fork through it before I said they were okay to eat. She totally knew what she was doing, too. I could tell from that glint in her eyes. Taking a deep breath, I said, "Sweetheart, wait, please." And she moaned. "But Mommy, I'm hungry, and Noemi's blood sugar is probably getting low."
Now, Aspen and Meredith are both kind of unlikable in their own ways. Two questions. Do you have a favorite, and was it hard to write people like that?
No, it's okay. So it's not at all hard to write them because I love unlikable female characters. Those are my favorite characters to read about and to write. And I would have to say my favorite character to write was Aspen. I can't give away too much, but I love writing her.
I'm very aware that we're dancing around spoiler territory. So
Let's
look at the bigger picture. The book kind of looks into, well, one of the aspects is it looks into the depression that can come from social media. Like, no one liked my Twitter posts. What am I doing wrong? Do you think that's a real problem?
So I can't speak for anyone else, but for me, it was definitely a real problem because it took me almost 10 years to get a publishing deal. And that whole time I was writing and just getting rejected by every publisher. And meanwhile, I would look at Facebook which is kind of giving away how old I am. But yeah, I would look at Facebook and I'd be like, oh my gosh, all of my friends are doing so well, you know, they're just off doing amazing things. And here I am just failing at life. And it really became very unhealthy for me.
Is that why you've been such a prolific author in the last few years? You've got all these drafts in a drawer?
Pretty much, yeah, because it took me so long to get published, I had to learn to write really fast. And then as soon as I got done writing a book, I would move on to the next one, just to kind of like fall in love with a new project. So I wasn't so hung up on the current one that might then go on to not sell to publishers. So because of that, like I learned to write super fast.
Now, looking back at the world of momfluencers, I can't say that word, momfluencers. Looking back upon the world of maternal influencers, how much of their output do you think is fake?
Gosh, okay, so this was partly inspired by an article I read, and it was titled something like, I'm leaving my wife because of aesthetics. And reading the title, I was like, what? That sounds really horrible. But then I read the article. And so this man, he was talking about how his wife started an Instagram account when she got pregnant, and then it grew really quickly. And then soon their life was just governed by aesthetics. And he felt like everything they did was fake. You know, she even faked their baby like standing up for the first time, because she didn't actually catch it on camera when the baby did actually stand up for the first time, but she did it again for her followers. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I need to write about this. So my guess would be that a lot of it is fake.
Yeah, there is a scene in the book where the husband gets in the shot of the baby mm-hmm. taking the first steps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What social media do you use now?
So I'm mostly on Instagram. I tried using TikTok, but I think it moves a little bit too fast for me.
I have looked at the post you made, write a book with me in 5 weeks. What mm-hmm. sort of feedback have you been getting from that?
It's been really positive on the whole. People have talked about how they tried some of the methods that I've shared, the most popular one being the 15-minute writing sprint. So it's where I set a timer for 15 minutes. And during those 15 minutes, I'm not allowed to do anything aside from writing. So I'm not allowed to delete things that I write. I'm not even allowed to take a sip of my coffee. It's just, you know, pure writing without stopping. And this really allows me to kind of turn off that critical part of my brain that's just going, you know, oh, this is crap. What are you doing? This doesn't make any sense. And people have told me that they tried it, they were really skeptical, and then they find that it works really well for them. So yeah, I've been really happy with the feedback.
Sometimes when you're writing like that, you get into a place where you're kind of zoned out. It's just you and the keyboard. If the 15-minute alarm goes off and you're in mm-hmm. that mood, do you force yourself to stop or do you just keep going?
Mm-hmm. When the timer goes off, I have to like pause. And then if I am in the zone, then I just start another 15-minute timer and then I go again immediately. But most of the time I do stop and then I take a break. You know, I sit back and sip my coffee and kind of gather my thoughts, and then I start another 15-minute timer.
And Jessie's whole interview can be found in episode 390. And finally, let's head to episode 398 and a chat with Booker winner of 2024, Samantha Harvey, and her book, Orbital. For over 10 years, RNIB and the Booker Foundation have worked together to make sure all of the books on the shortlist are available in audio and braille for blind and partially sighted readers. At a glittering ceremony, the winner of this year's prize was revealed to be Samantha Harvey. We'll hear from them in a moment, but first here's a clip of the winning title.
Orbit 1 into Orbit 2. You aren't even the farthest flung humans now, says ground control. How does that feel? For today, a crew of four is on its way to the moon and has just surpassed the space station's shallow orbiting distance of 250 miles above the planet. The lunar astronauts are catapulted past them in a $5 billion blaze of suited, booted glory. "For the first time ever, you've been overtaken," says ground crews. "You're yesterday's news," they joke. And Pietro jokes back that better yesterday's news than tomorrow's, if they know what he means. If you're an astronaut, you'd rather not ever be news. And here's the thing, thinks Chie. Her mother's down there, on that Earth. Everything that's left of her mother's down there. Better to be lassoing it like this than watching it disappear in the rearview mirror. Anton just looks out of the space viewing portal to where he knows the constellations of Pegasus and Andromeda to be. Though his vision can't readily sift them out among the millions of stars. He's tired. Doesn't sleep that well up here, mind too constantly jet-lagged and staggered. There's Saturn. There's the airplane shape of Aquila. The moon's a stone's throw. One day, he thinks, he'll get there.
So the book is set over one 24-hour period in low Earth orbit. So the book is set on a space station, which is essentially the ISS, although it's never called that in the book. And there are four astronauts, two cosmonauts on the space station. And it follows them over one day orbiting the Earth, so 16 sunsets and 16 sunrises, 16 transits of the Earth. And it's really a day in the life on the space station, and it's very much a book. I mean, first and foremost, I think a book about the Earth and the perspective that we have on the Earth from the distance of low Earth orbit.
With 16 orbits a day, the human body's kind of designed to be regulated by the sunset and the sunrise. That must really... The concept of time must be really hard to get when you're up on the space station.
Yeah, I imagine so. The books that I've read by astronauts talk about time quite a lot, obviously. And, you know, this, we're so on Earth, so tethered to our circadian rhythms and the 24-hour clock. In space, it doesn't really hold. I mean, the space stations and the ground crews do their best to try to keep that rhythm of a 24-hour day. And everything is scheduled, and they are on essentially Greenwich Mean Time. So they do their best to try to make it feel normal, but it's never going to feel normal, is it, when you're going around the Earth every 90 minutes? And that was one of the things I really wanted to try to encode into the book, into the structure of the book. So that's why I set it over one day, so that we have one 24-hour period, but that time period as we know it is exploded, and maybe the structure of the book being told through chapters which are numbered orbits might help to simulate perhaps for the reader a sense of the dislocation of that experience of time, which I imagine, and can only imagine, the astronauts and cosmonauts up there feel.
Yeah, you said can only imagine. A lot of authors will visit the place with a novel set, but this might be a bit of reach. But what was your research process?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would have loved to have gone there and been able to research from there, but I don't think most research grants don't stretch to that. So my research was mainly desk bound. I read a lot of books by astronauts. I read journals and diaries that astronauts have kept. There's a lot on the NASA website and the ESA, the European Space Agency website. You can sort of borrow quite deep into those sites and find quite a lot of archived material, really interesting stuff about daily life on the ISS. And there is, you know, there is so much information out there about the ISS. It's actually very easy to research. It's sort of knowing how to use that research and where to stop and when to let your imagination take hold. And I think that for me, the single biggest and most helpful element of my research was looking at images of the Earth from space. So it's a very visual book. I think it's, I wanted it to feel as much like a painting as it is a novel. And I
had on my desktop almost continually for the whole time of writing this book, you know, two and a half years or so, footage of the Earth from space. And I would make endless transits around the Earth, albeit from my desk, and try to describe what I saw. So that was my most direct form of inspiration and research. But then that was obviously augmented with written documents by astronauts and listening to interviews with astronauts and so on.
I've got a couple of monitors here, and one of them is the live feed from the ISS. So they're over Japan right now.
Oh, it's just magical, isn't it? And interestingly, that live feed doesn't work very often. Well, they might have improved it. When I was researching the book, it often wouldn't be working, but when it is working, it's just so it's so magnificent to be able to see what they can see. Oh, it's really, you know, the technology behind that and that the accessibility of it, I think, is really wonderful.
You kind of alluded to this in the last answer, but would you go up on the ISS?
Well, it depends. It depends on the day that I'm asked. Today, yeah, maybe I would.
Or even one of
Yes.
those, you know, like the Jeff Bezos flights where you kind of touch space.
Yeah, I think that would be worth doing. I mean, I am a really, really unadventurous person, so you know, it's easy for me to sit here now and say, yeah, why not? I think if it came to it, I'd probably be too cowardly to do it. I mean, it is a safe way of traveling in that, you know, astronauts and cosmonauts are going up and down there all the time. It's almost like a coach excursion to them. But it is, you know, it has many inherent dangers and it is very rough on the body. So would I? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I kind of take comfort in the fact that I would probably never have to make this decision, so I can safely say now, yeah, sure.
Sam Harvey, author of the Booker shortlisted Orbital, the audio version of which is read by Sarah Nowdy. A short extract of my interview with the winner of the 2024 Booker Prize. That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.